Let's start with what's going on in the Middle East. Right now, Netanyahu is in the United States. And at the same time, we're witnessing that Russia is trying to bring Bashar al-Assad and Erdogan together, talk to each other. On the other hand, China was bringing Palestinian groups together to make some sort of agreement among them. What's going on, in your opinion, when it comes to the Russia and China's policy in the Middle East against the United States foreign policy in the Middle East?
Well, I think that Netanyahu is trying to figure out how to keep the Americans on his side, no matter who's the next president. Right now, it's completely uncertain. So he's trying to figure out what's going to happen next, and probably not succeeding because nobody knows what'll happen next. As far as what's happening in Palestine, with Palestine, Hamas and Fatah have decided, their political arms, have decided to make peace with each other and work together as a unit. And that is a major achievement, because Israel created Hamas in order to split the Palestinians. And that strategy misfired in all kinds of ways, and now it turns out that it's not a strategy at all because they've merged. So that's a, you know, a complete fiasco from the Israeli point of view. In general, I think that Russia and China are trying to rise to the occasion because there's a gigantic vacuum. It's not like the United States is a side of the story. It's like the United States is missing. There's nobody in charge in the United States, and nobody knows who's going to be in charge and how it's going to develop, how it's going to turn out. And so Russia and China are trying to play the adults in the room and try to get people to talk. Now it's appearing as if the Arab states aren't really going to do anything about Israel or about Palestine. But Iran is the one entity that could produce some kind of peace in the region, and the entire diplomatic mission, as far as I can see it, is convincing the Iranians that they shouldn't destroy Israel, which they've been talking about for generations, and that they should actually be, as the most powerful, militarily the most powerful nation in the region, they should try to achieve some sort of peace with Israel, which is difficult, if not impossible. So that, as far as I can tell, is what's going on.
In your opinion, is Netanyahu looking for some sort of permissions to fight Hezbollah in the United States and to bring the United States into the conflict in Gaza?
Well, that has been Israel's dream all along, to get the United States embroiled in the conflict. The entire provocation against Iran, to which Iran responded, resulted in the Americans in the region helping counter the Iranian counterattack with mixed results. Whatever the Iranians wanted to get through did get through, because Iranians have better weapons at this point, along with the Russians, the Chinese, and the North Koreans. But you know, that I don't think that's going to work. I think the gambit of trying to get the Americans involved in a Middle Eastern conflict is not going to work. The Americans have already burnt a prodigious amount of military equipment in the Ukraine. This is vaguely similar to the amount of military hardware they lost during World War II, except here they lost it over a very short period of time, as opposed to spread out. And they've also demonstrated that their weapons are obsolete and relatively useless. Of course, they made lots of money doing that, but they're not really in a position to blunder into another open-ended military conflict with no specific goal except to please Israel. What Netanyahu is trying to do is to stay out of jail and extend his political career. There, I don't think he has any other options at this point.
And when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, how do you find right now what's going on between Ukraine on one side and Hungary and Slovakia on the other side? What does Ukraine want from this kind of behavior that they're committing right now?
They wanted to please Brussels by shutting down the export of Russian oil to Hungary and to Slovakia. The response was one delayed response, which is the Ukraine will no longer get diesel from Slovakia, and that will hamper its efforts to continue the military conflict in the east. And there was also an immediate reaction, which is Slovakia turned off the electricity. Slovakia and Hungary are the two biggest electricity exports to the Ukraine now that a lot of Ukrainian generating capacity has been destroyed, resulting in blackouts even in Kiev, where electricity remains out for sometimes days at a time. And people are confronting this unfamiliar situation where their earnings, their salaries, are deposited to bank cards electronically, but they can't withdraw the money because the bank machines don't run because the electricity is off, and there are no electronic payment systems working because the electricity is off, and so they can't get at their money. And so they can't even ride public transit to work because they can't pay for it, and everything is just breaking down because of that. So the Ukraine tried to please Brussels and shot themselves in the foot, which is, I guess, exactly what we should expect from them.
We've learned from Joseph Borrell, he's talking about more than 70% of the energy capacity of Ukraine have been destroyed. And when you look at this, look at the casualties on the part of Ukrainian, which is huge, 55,000 casualties just in June. And the manpower, the aid that they're receiving is reducing hugely. Germany just cut the aid, is just less than half that they were sending to Ukraine before. On the other hand, you see that the European Union behind the scene is trying to convince Zelensky that he can continue this conflict. He can go on and on. Why do you understand why what the European Union is doing, and what's the main goal of the European Union right now? Is it related to what's going on with the Democratic Party in the United States, or they're seeking some sort of different agenda?
Of course, it is. It has to do with the mayhem in Washington. The Euro puppets are absolutely scared because Trump is going to come, they think, and deprive them of everything that they've counted on throughout their political careers, which is basically being able to hide behind Uncle Sam's back, doing exactly what the Americans tell them to do, and not worry about anything. And that does not seem like it's going to work. Now there's continued support for the Ukraine is just an outcome of their abject fear that if they say something something different, then it might make things even worse than they already are. And so it's kind of it's a zombie policy. Now, as far as what the Ukrainians are doing, it's a zombie nation. They've been so brainwashed that on the one hand, something like two-thirds of Ukrainians want peace, right? That's what they say. On the other hand, also approximately two-thirds of them want all of their territory back, which is now part of the Russian Federation. And so those two things just don't add up. And what will happen to these poor Ukrainians who have been brainwashed by this Anglo-Saxon brainwashing machine is that they'll need a lot of medical treatment, a lot of psychiatry, in order to overcome these faulty ideas that have been implanted in their brains. It'll take a long time, and some of them will never recover. But it has nothing to do with the progress of the special military operation from the Russian point of view.
How do you find the Russian position right now if the West decides, let's assume Trump wins the election in 2024 and he wants to negotiate with Russia? What would be on the table for Russia to negotiate with Donald Trump?
Russia has spelled out what is required in order to start negotiations. First of all sanctions have to be dropped. They're illegal anyway. So no more sanctions against Russia from the European Union or from the United States. That's number one. So that should be Trump's opening gambit. In order to be invited to the negotiating table with the Russians, he'd have to do that. Second, all of the territories that, based on the results of public referenda, have left Ukraine and have joined the Russian Federation. There are five of them. They have to be recognized as such. The Ukrainian troops have to get out of there, and everybody has to recognize those as the new borders of Russia. Then, Ukraine has to basically sign into law that it will not be joining NATO. It will not be joining military blocs. There will be no foreign troops stationed on Ukrainian soil, and that the Ukraine will demilitarize. It will surrender all of its weapons or destroy them, except for a little bit of a policing capacity. So those are the requirements that the Russians have stipulated, that have to be met in order for the Ukraine to begin, or whoever negotiates on the Ukraine's behalf, because there's nobody to negotiate with in the Ukraine. It doesn't have a president. It won't have a parliament as of August 11th. So there's nobody to talk to in the Ukraine. But if the Americans decide to negotiate on behalf of their protectorate, that's what would have to happen first. Those are the prerequisites. And then after that, if there's anything left to negotiate, that's fine. But if the Americans do all of that, then that's fine too.
In your opinion, Trump would be able to change the policies toward Russia in the United States?
I don't think he wants to do anything about Ukraine and Russia. The best that would happen as far as American foreign policy is that there wouldn't be any because the United States will become overwhelmed with domestic problems. This has to do with the fact that the petrodollar system is gone, with the fact that countries around the world are unloading US treasuries and loading up on gold. It has to do with the fact that there are now other countries that are the trusted partners as far as the entire international system, and those are Russia and China, and the United States is pretty well ignored because their stick of showing up and making demands and ordering people around will no longer work at all. And they're no longer frightening militarily, except for their nuclear weapons, which everybody knows will result in the United, their use will result in the United States getting destroyed, so they won't be used. So the United States got nothing except lots and lots of domestic problems. So the best that Trump can do is concentrate on those domestic problems, because it'll be a problem of survival for a lot of people. And just completely ignore the Ukraine and Russia.
But it's important for Europeans that they have been following the United States foreign policy in Ukraine for more than 2 years in this conflict. And right now they're thinking who's going to win in the United States. And depending on it would be Kamala Harris or Donald Trump, that would be totally different for the European Union and the way that they're seeing, because right now the war in Ukraine is in their neighborhood. It's so influential on their economy, on their security. That's why I think the United States would get more involved, because Trump wants to do some sort of deal with Russia and European Union. That would be amazing to see what would be the reaction coming out of the European Union.
Well, Russia doesn't really have much to do with the European Union. It has given up on it. Russia is interested in bilateral relations with various countries, economic, cultural, etc. It is rather disappointed in the entire Russophobic slant that Europeans have taken on. And hopes that in a decade or so this will all be over. And Lavrov just recently said that Russia doesn't really have an issue with the Europeans. It has an issue with European politicians, and will patiently wait for those politicians to lose their jobs. As far as making deals, forget it. What deals? With whom? Why? The Russians have already said that there's no reason to deal with the European politicians. There's no conversation. There's no possibility of a conversation. The European Union, as far as Russia is concerned, is not a partner, not somebody you can even talk to. It's a waste of time. And similarly, with Americans, talking to them is sort of a waste of time, because the Russians have tried that before, and that wasn't very, very helpful, wasn't very conducive, because the Americans sign whatever they negotiate at any given moment, and then something changes, and they renege on their promises, and they're just not trustworthy. They're not people of their word. So the Russians have had enough of that. And the thing to understand is that things are going very well for Russia. The relations with Europe are not really a requirement. The war in Ukraine, the special military operation, will be won no matter what the Americans or the Europeans try to do. And so there is no real reason to negotiate. But if Russia gets everything it asked for, then it would be able to end the hostilities rather quickly, and that would be a good thing. Whether that happens or not is, your guess.
Do you see Ukraine being part of becoming part of the EU?
If the people in charge of the EU are sufficiently insane, yes. The Ukraine is the largest, would be the largest country in the EU. Not necessarily by population, but by territory and by the number of problems. It is an absolutely devastated landscape. If it joins the EU, then the borders are suddenly open, and the Ukrainians will flood into the rest of Europe, basically demanding satisfaction. They will say, "You sent us to the slaughter in the East, knowing full well that we couldn't possibly win against Russia, being relatively small and relatively badly equipped with your obsolete and useless weapons. You caused a huge number of our people to die for no good reason. You did all that, and now it's payback time. We're not going to work. We're just going to freeload." So how good is that going to be for the European Union? If the people in charge of the European Union have a brain at all, they would never accept the Ukraine.
Don't you think that if Trump wins, that would be beneficial for the position of Orban, who's trying to bring some sort of sanity to the conflict in Ukraine, and even with China? And because Kamala Harris is totally different from what Trump represents as in terms of the foreign policy of the United States in Europe. How do you find Trump helping Orban?
I don't see that Trump would have any time for Europe at all. He would be just completely immersed in the huge web of very serious problems that will bedevil the United States over his entire term. I don't think he'll be able to lift his head up enough to pay attention to any foreign country. The United States is losing, and he knows it. And it'll be all that he can do to keep the United States from disintegrating, never mind helping Orban. What does the US care about Hungary? Why is Hungary important to the United States? Why is the Ukraine important to the United States at this point? It is not. So it, you know. That's as far as Trump. As far as Kamala, well, that's a funny question because the only reason Kamala got picked as vice president, other than her dark skin, she's not actually African American, she's Indian. There's no love lost between the Indians and the Africans in America. But the reason she got picked is that she's dumber than Biden and made him look good. And whoever thought of basically getting rid of Biden and having Kamala step in thought twice because she's this cackling fool who makes no sense. So what does a cackling fool who makes no sense mean for foreign policy of the United States? She has no idea, and neither do I.
So you're talking about what would happen if Trump wins in the United States, just involving him with domestic problems. And what, in your opinion, what would they make for him just in order just distracting him from what's going on?
Oh, I don't mean political issues. I mean real world issues of the United States in terminal decline and people becoming really, really unhappy as their standard of living drops precipitously. That is going to be a very large issue. One thing that may happen over the next 4 years is that there'll be major declines in oil production from the shale oil provinces. It is not no longer growing. It is at a, on a plateau, but it the specifics, the physical specifics of shale oil production, are such that is a it is a very fast depleting resource, and all of the best places to drill have already been drilled. Now all the effort is going into sustaining production, and that may no longer be possible in maybe 6 months, maybe 2 years. But once the United States becomes once again a major oil importer, given the structure of its economy, it's a profligate burner of oil. It produces a rather tiny, relatively tiny amount of gross domestic product per unit oil energy. It is extremely energy inefficient. So once that happens, the United States will no longer be able to compete at all economically. The other problem is that, it has basically a completely out of control fiscal situation that it can't do anything about. At this point, the fact that the process of taking on ever more debt ever more quickly is going to falter because people are not around the world are not snapping up those that American debt as fast as they used to. All of those things could basically doom whoever the next president is. So in fact, I hope that it's Kamala because she won't even know what happened or care.
If that's the case, the way that you're describing the situation in the United States, do you think that in the European Union, do they have any sort of understanding on what's going on and what you've been describing for us here? And what do they think, in your opinion?
Well, in Europe, they basically have an anti-democracy where they have become very well at completely ignoring the will of the people and doing whatever their puppet masters across the ocean tell them to do. So now the puppet masters are failing. They're growing weaker. Their voice is becoming softer and more confused. And so these puppets that have been put in place in Europe no longer know what to do. They're at a loss. All they know how to do is to hold on to the system that has been created and to repeat the talk various talking points that have been sent to them from on high. So the British, for instance, are now preparing to go to war with Russia in 2 years. The Germans are preparing to use the ports in northern Germany to shuttle something like 1 million troops to the Russian border to resist Russian aggression because they've been told that Russians are aggressive and will invade. That's the dumbest thing in the world. The Russians don't really care about Europe at all. In fact, the Russians are rather afraid that they'll be saddled with Eastern Europe again and will have to feed those people. So there's a lot of ridiculousness going on, but nothing, no recognition of reality of what's actually happening, because the people in charge are not capable of that sort of rational thinking.
The other important point in Trump's vision right now is the policy toward China. He has decided to have J.D. Vance as his vice president, and he's totally against the conflict in Ukraine. But when it comes to China, it seems that he has some sort of different attitude. Do you understand what would be the Trump's policy toward China or Iran?
Well, it would de definitely have nothing to do with what J.D. Vance wants, because he's running for vice president, and vice presidents in the United States don't decide anything at all. They have no influence. So what J.D. Vance thinks is relevant to the campaign, except most Americans don't care about foreign policy. So it's just something to throw around on the campaign trail to for gravitas, to show that this administration will be tough and will be tough on the Chinese because everybody's sick of hearing about being tough on the Russians, and that didn't work out very well. So let's try the Chinese this time. Doesn't really mean anything. So Trump is talking about this economic war in China where he'll impose huge tariffs on Russian goods, Chinese goods. Block some of them, etc. Well, that's a good way to shut down what's left of American industry, because it is at this point just basically devoted to assembling things out of Chinese-made stuff. If he really gets into a trade war with China, a serious one, then the military defense establishment in the United States would be the first to suffer because all of the components they use, a lot of them are Chinese made. So this is not something that can be done. And so I would say that this is election time rhetoric. And the notable thing about Americans is what they promise during an election campaign has absolutely nothing to do with what they do once they're elected. Nothing at all.
When you look at Africa, look at the Middle East, look at Europe, the situation is totally different from what it was during those days. And how the question is, how Trump going to manage the situation in his opinion, in his way, when the picture is totally changing and changing drastically?
I don't think he will. I think he'll pretty well ignore it. There's nothing to be done. It's all happened already. The United States is no longer the dominant power in the world. This is not something that he can do. His personality is not suitable to being a humble person and devoting his time to studying technical details and figuring out small point solutions to various types of problems where the United States could still help things along in some small way. He's full of bombast, and that will just make people laugh at this point. And so he will likely do things in the same manner that he tried to do with Kim Jong-un, for instance, where Kim Jong-un took Trump at his word and actually shut down the facility that he used to test nuclear weapons. And Trump completely failed to do what he promised to do in return. And that's the end of story. So there will be no more negotiation of any sort between the United States and North Korea. And similar things have happened with Russia. Similar things have happened with Iran. What country is there left in the world that was not fooled by the Americans, where they agreed to do something and then they didn't do it? So there was a time when that didn't matter because everybody had to do what the Americans told them to do or else. And that time, those days are gone and will never come back. So, but old habits die hard. And so Trump will try to impose himself on the situation and fail. And then make a brave face and go home and do something else, just as he did with North Korea.
Getting back to the first question, talking about Turkey and Bashar al-Assad going to Russia and negotiating and talking to each other. How do you find the position of Turkey right now? And they want to be part of BRICS, they want to be part of the SCO, and at the same time, they're part of NATO. Do you find it tricky for BRICS to accept Turkey being part of BRICS, or Turkey totally understands what's going on and they want to find their path toward their right position?
Well, I think that there's a whole lot of ambiguity to Turkey's situation. On the one hand, they're sort of allies with the United States. On the other hand, the United States has tried repeatedly to overthrow the Turkish government and kill Erdogan. So there's a great deal of hatred of Americans in Turkey. And then on the one hand, there's an effort to on the part of Turkey to have kind of a pro-Western foreign policy where they even sold some weapons to the Ukrainians and did some very unsavory things, such as breaking agreements with Russia on releasing the Nazi battalion people who got arrested and got rounded up in Mariupol, releasing those back to the Ukrainians so they could go back and fight. That was something that Turkey did that was just an insult to Russia. They broke the deal. So there isn't really a kind of a very smooth and polished relationship between Russia and BRICS and Turkey. It's going to be rough. But on the other hand, Turkey is rather helpful, or has been, in helping Russia get around EU sanctions. It is one of the major transshipment points for all of the goods that have been sanctioned that Russia still wants to buy. Of course, if Turkey didn't do it, then Kazakhstan would do it, and if Kazakhstan wouldn't do it, then some other country would. That doesn't really matter. And Turkey profited handsomely from that entire operation. So Turkey is always ambiguous. There isn't any straightforward way to say, well, it's on this side or that side. It's always on its own side or several sides at once.
And when it comes to Turkey and Erdogan and Bashar al-Assad talking to each other, how do you find the importance of this for Gaza and what's going on in Gaza?
I don't know. They've talked before. Talk is cheap. The fact that they're now sort of reestablishing relations, that's a good move, but then something could happen and ruin the whole thing. That's how things have been happening for a really long time. There isn't really any love between them, but they could cooperate on a few points here and there. I don't know that it immediately means anything specifically for Gaza.
But in terms of the geopolitical situation of that region, does that mean anything?
I don't know. It could change tomorrow. Today they're talking, tomorrow they might stop talking. That's happened before.
But right now, we can have some sort of the same kind of deal that we had between Iran and Saudi Arabia, right now between Turkey and Syria. It's important if it goes that way, isn't it?
Well, that would be nice, but I'm not really expecting that. They're not at war with each other. The situation around their border is complicated and will remain that way. The big problem for Syria is expelling Americans. It's parts of Syria still occupied by Americans, and there are American army bases there. So getting rid of those is the big challenge for Syria. There's nothing specifically about Turkey that offends the Syrians too much. The fact that they're talking, well, maybe they'll help solve some of the major refugee problem of all of those Syrians who are living in Turkey and have been for almost a generation now. So that's really the thing for them to talk about, not geopolitics,
Yeah.
humanitarian issues.